Hello and welcome to this week's Unbreak My Chart, the podcast that tapes the top 10 and talks about it at school the next day. I'm Fraser McAlpine.
I'm Laura Snapes.
And this week we would normally be talking about what we've been up to in the week, the amazing music that we've been listening to and the fun times that we've been having. But political events have rather overtaken everything because Article 50 has been signed and we have Brexited, Laura. That means scary things are going on in the world and they presumably will have an impact on pop.
Yes, well, the main thing that I've noticed today, this being Sunday, the day before most people will hear the podcast, is that apparently war with Spain over Gibraltar might be imminent. So, yeah, we can only imagine the pop that this might result from this.
Yes, very sad ballads about the things that happened in the war for Gibraltar, which, you know, would be an interesting, considering so many of the 1970s pop hits were actually made in people going on holiday in Spain and bringing back things like Viva España. There's an interesting time. What has also happened, though, is that you had the genius idea of going to look at the top 10 from the week in which we joined the EU, which was January the 1st, 1973. And so we're going to start with a chart countdown, but with a difference. This one is almost the same age as I am. This is 44 years old.
Mm-hmm. From December 31st, 1972 was the last pre-EU chart. Should we do the full rundown?
Yeah, please.
Right, at number 10, it's Wings with Hi, Hi, Hi and Sea Moon, which was banned on the radio for it being a drug reference, apparently. Hi, 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 that is. At number 9 is The Moody Blues and Nights in White Satin, which I knew nothing about.
Oh, really? This is a song I grew up. I thought it was always released. It was in the charts all of my youth, because I grew up in the 70s. And this was released in 1967, but it seems to be in the singles chart all the time. And it was you know, one of those maudlin 1960s songs where they're sort of veiledly talking about being incredibly sexy times at night. But it also sounds like they're on a quest for the Holy Grail at the same time, because, you know, because pureness and all that stuff.
The video is profoundly unsexy. It's a lot of man with really awful facial hair standing on some stairs looking quite serious.
Well, that's love, isn't it? That's what love feels like. It feels really, really serious and rolling around in a bed made of, you know, with sheets of satin that are white.
Yes, well, I mean, that's a big theme in the Bruno Mars single that we were discussing the other day. At number 8 is Roy C and Shotgun Wedding.
We don't know if this was a single that was popular because it was on the Northern Soul Sings. It's a 1965 soul record, Shotgun Wedding, and it was in the early 70s charts, which quite a few songs were because they'd been picked up by the Northern Soul scene. But also, Shotgun Wedding seems quite a pointed song title for the week in which we joined the EU, for people perhaps who didn't want to join the EU. So maybe people were buying it to play ironically at their work's Christmas party or something.
And as we're going to get onto later, there is an equivalent to Shotgun Wedding in this week's chart. Maybe tenuous, not sure that's what they were going for when they created it, but there's definitely a good link.
We can see links everywhere. We see patterns.
At number 7 is Chuck Berry with the frankly egregious My Ding-a-Ling, which is also banned by the BBC.
Laura, had you heard this song before?
I think I'd probably seen it on some kind of horrible BBC 4 clip show, yeah.
It's ridiculous. The thing with My Ding-a-Ling is it contains absolutely everything that made Chuck Berry great, bar the guitar playing. It's the only thing that's missing. It's got the wordplay, it's quite clever with the lyrics, it's sly, it's got a little bit of a half smirk, but it is absolutely awful. There's no question that this is the worst record that he ever had, and also, you know, one of his biggest hits. And he was very pleased to play it whenever anybody wanted him to play it, because, you know, he was a man who liked to be a crowd pleaser. But it's just entertaining that he never stopped being Chuck Berry, but at some point people just went, okay, that's enough now. This is quite too much.
Also, he's riding the child wave that's clearly, so that sounds really disgusting, but that's clearly a foot around this period, as we're going to get onto with the number one song, which is definitely a novelty kid record, and you saying that Paul McCartney came back with it. Did you say it was a cover of Mary Had a Little Lamb? It's clearly something in the air.
Yeah, it's not good. And there is a live performance, which I mean, I don't know if it is Top of the Pops, but there is a live performance that was filmed on, presumably the BBC, of him singing in a room full of children, and, you know, to which the adults are presumably all nudging each other and going, haha, these tiny idiots have got no idea what they're singing about. And I'm just like, well, it's like watching Are You Being Served now, when you look back and you see, you know, Mrs. Slocum talking about her pussy, and you just think, well, clearly language has moved on, because there is no residual innuendo left in this thing about your cat. It doesn't sound like you're talking about your cat at all. So it's that kind of thing. The 1970s was an alien era, even to me.
I don't think the innuendo was buried that deeply in it. I was just reading the Wikipedia page earlier, and I think there's a quote from Mary Whitehouse where she talks about a teacher going into a classroom and finding a group of very little boys playing with their own ding-a-ling. So clearly it wasn't lost on them at the time either.
Oh, well, kids are clever. They'll get it. It's just that the adults think they're stupid.
Grim. At number six is John and Yoko with Happy Christmas War Is Over.
Well, which, you know, and again, a similar position in the chart every year since then, around that time of year.
And number five is Slade with Goodbye to Jane, which I had never heard before. Though Slade are one of those bands that I really feel like I should actually go and listen beyond the hits, because I understand they are actually very good and much better than just the Christmas single.
Oh, definitely. I mean, actually, there's a thing that happens with, if you explore a little bit into Slade, I think it actually sheds new light back on the Christmas single, because that is only been dulled by over familiarity. There are, it's a great song, the Christmas song.
Oh yeah, and, I love, you know, it.
Yeah, exactly. But it's so unusual, and it was written as this psychedelic hit for Noddy Holden wanted to write a really out there psychedelic song with psychedelic chord changes, but then he just ended up putting loads of words in about Father Christmas and your gran getting drunk and stuff, and that you can definitely hear both of those things fighting it out in the song. I think it's one of the reasons that makes it great. Goodbye to Jane is not one of their ones that I like a lot. It's all right.
Number four is David Bowie with The Gene Genie,
which is two of the young people in my house's favourite David Bowie song. So my 15-year-old son loves it, and my 3-year-old son also loves it.
Excellent. Number three is The Osmonds with Crazy Horses, which is a song that I only heard on Friday when I was actually watching Top of the Pops reruns on BBC 4. This is an extraordinary song.
What did you think?
Well, the things, I thought that the Osmonds were just like a simpering TV boy band. That's really all that I knew about them. That and, like, you know, what Donny Osmond has become later in life as a TV presenter. And then to see this song, I mean, they look like five slightly mutated Harry Styles all playing a different instrument. And yeah, it's really hysterical, hard-charging song about, like, gas-guzzling cars and the perils of global warming. I can only imagine how this was actually received at the time, and also what Neil Young and Crazy Horse must have made about it. it's really weird, but also very enjoyable, and I may purchase a copy for future listening.
It's fantastic. It is exactly as you say. It's an absolute outlier in the Osmonds catalogue. It was the point at which their record company apparently was saying, well, this is a stupid idea. Why are you releasing a song like this? It's got heavy metal guitars on it. What is that horrible shrieking noise? Which a lot of people attribute to being a theremin, but it's not. There's a Yamaha keyboard that has a ribbon controller that makes that noise that allows you to sort of slide between notes on a keyboard with a kind of glissando sort of effect. So it's not a theremin, but it is similar to, you know, the Good Vibrations theremin, which is among the most terrifying noises in all of pop music. What I love about Crazy Horses as well, to me, is they really sound like the Muppets. There's something incredibly Muppety about Crazy Horses, which is, it makes it even more endearing. But it is a massive, yeah, it's so different from anything that they ever did, anything anybody was doing in pop music at the time. They never went back to anything like it with anything like the same degree of success. And every time I see the clip from Top of the Pops, when they do show that clip and they're wearing kind of leather bondage gear and over the top of their white jumpsuits, it's just like, isn't pop music amazing? Isn't pop music wonderful that it can throw this stuff up?
Well, by the looks of it, the Harry Styles single, which is coming out next weekend, is also going to be a serious banger, or purposeful pop, as Katy Perry might have it. I can't remember what it's called, but it's called something like Save the World, or it's something about listening to the world. And it looks, from the artwork and the title, like it might be quite a serious meditation on what's going on right now. So I like the idea that he might be continuing what the Osmonds were doing in 1972.
That's the benchmark. If he's going to do it, he's got to do it that madly. And then everybody will be just at his feet. to be that arresting sonically, and you know, and in the context of a former boy band member being amazing, because we'll get onto this with Zane's stuff later on. I think the expectations for former boy band solo stuff early days aren't particularly high, or at least the paths that they tread are very familiar. Whereas Harry Styles has the opportunity to blow some minds, and I really hope he does.
Me too. Let's finish the 1972 chart. At number two is T-Rex with Solid Gold, Easy Action.
Which is sort of towards the end of their run of hits. This is scarily in 1972. This is the, you know, this is where T-Rexacy starts to taper off, and David Bowie takes over a bit.
Yeah, I wasn't particularly excited by that song. And then at number one is Little Jimmy Osmond with Long Haired Lover from Liverpool, which, you know, I think as far as songs go, this is pure Brexit.
Yeah. Now, again, Laura, had you heard this song before?
Yeah, so I had heard this because it's like a novelty kid record, and it's horrible. I don't think it's one that I've ever sat all the way through.
No, I mean, I'm too young to have found this charming ever, and I don't remember it being played at birthday parties and stuff when I was a kid, and I've always thought it was horrible, saccharine, you know, shrill. Oh my God, it's shrill. The kind of song that makes you think, oh, there are people that make music that really hate music and want it to die. Oh, okay. Let's put that out then. You know, and what's there is a total parallel, though, between this chart and our current chart, in that current chart completely besieged by Ed Sheeran, who is capable of, you know, some interesting moments and also total cynical musical exploitation of his fans. And here we've got two records by the Osmonds, one and three. One is, you know, awful, and the other is one of the most sublime pop music moments ever that have ever happened. So, I mean, I don't know what this tells us about the state of where we are in terms of going into the future with Brexit. Maybe the current top 10 will offer some answers.
Well, the top 10 that we've just looked at, there are some interesting kind of, you get there's some interesting generational divides there. You get the sense of one, a past being left behind and a new future slightly being forged. Things like the Moody Blues and Royce and Chuck Berry, and even the Osmonds, well, the Little Jimmy Osmond song. Those things always sound like they all sound like a kind of a past that's receding. Whereas with things like David Bowie, even though he's had a few hits by this point, and John and Yoko and Wings, that feels like new frontiers opening up slightly.
Yeah, we're going somewhere. Shall we move on to this week's top 10?
Yes, we're going to be relatively brisk this week because there's a lot of ground that we're going to be retreading and some more interesting stuff coming afterwards. So at number 10 is Drake with Blem, which is a track from More Life that was not in the top 10 last week but has been climbing.
I'm kind of glad that it is in the top 10 now because blem is a very, very pleasing word to say. It means high on marijuana, if anybody, for our older listeners. So he's saying essentially that being in love feels like being high on marijuana. And also, while we're on lexicographical stuff in the song Passion Fruit, I did read a really interesting thing online, sort of on a comments board, about how he's using... He says passion and passing and passive in the chorus, and obviously the title Passion Fruit, and he's using it to in the sense of the Christian passion to denote suffering. So love is a kind of suffering. I mean, this blog post was claiming that he'd done that on purpose, and who am I to argue?
I like the idea that he might be that calculating, but then also I also enjoy in this song how he says that now that he is high, he might just say how I feel, as if Drake has ever needed to be high to just say how I feel. That kind of shows a fundamental misunderstanding of his own back catalogue. One thing that...
Either that or he's really high a lot.
Well, yes. Well, there's been a lot of speculation this week. I think he's, like, cancelled maybe three shows in a row or something, and there's a lot of speculation that he's just been getting really high before shows and pulling massive whiteys and not being able to come out, which I think would be the ultimate proof that he can't really commit to the Jamaican culture that he's been riding for the past couple of years, and especially so on this song.
He also seems to say... I've read a lot of lexicographical posts about Drake this week. Someone pointed out that he says he couldn't slash and stay friends, and the people on this particular forum were like, does he mean smash? Does he mean like smash and stay friends in that kind of, you know, a description of the pneumatic reality of sex? Because slash is just not a slang term that anybody there was familiar with. I'm not familiar with it as a kind of, you know, as a hookup term, but from a British perspective, that word means having a wee.
Yeah, maybe he just finds it really hard to have a wee next to his male collaborators.
and stay friends. You see me wing, that's it. You're dead to me now.
Moving on, at number 9 is Anne Marie and Ciao Adios. That's the song that we thought might be the shotgun wedding of this chart. Maybe she's saying Ciao Adios to the EU. Very unlikely, but possible.
Well, we thought it was interesting that we're about to divorce ourselves from Europe at a time where so much of quality pop music is European, specifically from Scandinavia. So, you know, I think we're going to lose out. British pop needs to step up its game if it's going to compete. You know, we're not where we were in the early 70s. But this, the interesting thing about Anne-Marie, I discovered, and this is probably spoken a lot about over Christmas, and it's one of those statistics that just gets missed anyway, is that Rockabye, the single that she did with Clean Bandit, was the first Christmas number one that wasn't affiliated to anything else in popular culture, like The X Factor, or it wasn't a movie spin-off, it wasn't part of a Facebook campaign, it wasn't a charity single, there wasn't any reason for that single to be number one in the charts at Christmas, apart from the fact that the most people had either listened to it or bought it at that time. And that's the first time that's happened since 2001, which means there's an entire pop generation who've grown up with the Christmas number one being something that is artificially manipulated by exterior pop culture.
Whereas with Anne-Marie and Clean Bandit, your violin's quite festive. Maybe that was the reason why.
A little bit of Sean Paul never does you any harm.
Oh yeah, of course. At number 8 is Martin Jensen and Solo Dance, which I have nothing to say about this song. Number 7 is Kygo and Selena Gomez and It Ain't Me.
Now, this part, we've been talking a little bit about this, has sort of snuck up on us because we sort of were positing the theory a couple of weeks ago that the way that successful chart stars who've had a break from either the limelight or from getting hit singles can manage to manipulate their way back is to work with a dance producer. And, you know, some kind of trop house type hit would be even better, thanks. And so Kygo and Selena Gomez, that's what they're doing. But we were looking at the new releases for the next couple of weeks, and Pixie Lott is working with a dance producer. Natasha Bedingfield is working with a dance producer. So Pixie Lott has a single called Baby that she's done with Anton Powers, which is, I mean, it's slightly jazzy, isn't it? But it's still sort of Pixie Lott-esque, but then it becomes that thing that it needs to be. It becomes more of a dance hit. Are you coming home? I need to know.
It's definitely got a lot of Clean Bandit in it. There's a lot of strings in there. When she performed it on The Voice recently, it starts with just her singing, so everyone's like, "All right, yeah, Pixie Lott, we know what she's like." But then all of a sudden, there's this giant whoosh, and they reveal the Anton Powers dude at the back and a whole string section. But it's not that I feel sorry for her. I have absolutely no feelings towards Pixie Lott whatsoever. But it feels kind of sad that somebody who was a very well-established solo artist has had to hitch their wagon to something incredibly bland that removes all of your personality from the track in order to have a shot at coming back.
It's weird, isn't it? I've the only thing Pixie Lott has ever done that I've thought, oh, this is wonderful, was Boys and Girls. And the reason I liked it was because I worked this out after repeatedly listening to it and wondering why it was, you know, that particular chorus really stuck in my head, is because it's basically the chorus to the Super Furry Animals song, The Man Don't Give an F. This is a non-swearing podcast. But it's the same, that loop, that Steely Dan loop, and it's got the same groove and everything. It's like someone has gone, we need a clean-cut version of that to give to Pixie Lott, and we'll make it about, you know, standard pop fare, boys and girls having fun and all that. And it should be, it should seem like a cynical thing to do, but I just love it because that Super Furry Animals song is one of the best songs ever made. So I'm fine with it. But it's everything since then has always just been like, oh, are you not going to do that? Anything else that you're not going to remake anything else that I already like for me? No? Okay. That's a shame.
And with the Natasha Bedingfield song as well, she was one of the most distinctive British pop voices of like the early mid 2000s. And you can't tell that it's her at all on this song. And she's also done another kind of lazy tropical house banger this week called Let Go, which is in association with an iced tea company's mindfulness campaign, which is also pretty dispiriting. But I thought if we've got her back and also Jamiroquai also back, surely it's only a matter of time before Daniel Bedingfield also comes back. We can complete the early 2000s, well, not trifecta, but, you know, all the standard bearers.
It's a scary thought. Daniel Bedingfield, I think, possibly was one of those moments when he wasn't around anymore and you thought, oh, time has moved on. We aren't, you know, because the modern era always just seems to be always, you know, that you don't notice time passing and fashions changing until you look back. But the point at which Daniel Bedingfield disappeared felt to me like, oh, right, we've definitely moved into the new millennium now, and we aren't where we were at the end of the 1990s or the beginning, you know, in the year 2000. So I don't know that I want him back. But then if Rick Astley can come back...
Yeah, and Craig David as well. I not that I want Daniel Bedingfield to come back, but I believe that it's a possibility.
I mean, what do we think about Jamiroquai? I mean, he's come back with a Daft Punk-style synth-pop, electro-pop funk song called Automaton, which just proves that he's one of those artists that can operate in an area which is entirely devoid of subtext. He doesn't need to think, oh, people, I'm actually a robot now. I'm a robot. And he might as well have called it, you know, Robot Cowboy or The Return of the Robot Cowboy. It's remarkably Daft Punky.
Yeah, I've only listened to it once and I quite liked it. But the thing that I've most enjoyed about Jamiroquai this week is he's played his first live shows in quite a long time. I think there was one in Paris and then there was one in London. And I think there's a detail from the Paris show I read a review about. He comes on where he used to wear like an Indian headdress on stage, which, you know, is a bit inappropriate. You wouldn't get away with that now. And so instead he's turned it into a kind of lit up Statue of Liberty kind of thing, something you might pick up at Disneyland, which has got LCD kind of lights in it. But halfway through the gig, the lights on it went out and he had to go and put it backstage to recharge it. That's not a metaphor for a career. I mean, it's a good job his whole tour sold out in about 5 seconds, otherwise people would be pouncing on that.
My hat doesn't work. Because it's like a Samson and Delilah situation, isn't it? Without the hat, is Jamiroquai Jamiroquai? Who is he without the hat?
At number six is the Chainsmokers and Coldplay with Something Like This.
Yes. Now, last week we were wondering, I mean, in the spirit of constructive criticism, I think, because we like Chris Martin, why Coldplay would do this sort of dance type song. But again, by wandering through the new releases section next week of the songs that are coming up, we are listening to comeback singles by the Kooks and by Texas. Maybe they have to, because... there have been two. There are two approaches, I think, if you're a classic rock/pop artist who is making a comeback. I mean, do we think that anybody from the rock/pop area could possibly have a chart hit single these days with their classic sound?
Oh my goodness, what a question. Did Kaiser Chiefs manage it? I didn't really listen to a lot of their comeback stuff.
I don't think they did. No, I think they. I mean, you know, the classic chart position for any indie type guitar band is always the mid 20s and lower. But I don't. I mean, certainly not top 10 stuff.
No, I don't think so. I can't think of any of those early 2000s ones. I mean, something like Foo Fighters aren't a charting band, and you know that whole Franz Ferdinand Block Party Libertines thing that definitely wouldn't get up there now. It would have to be some kind of reality TV, a better thing, like that period where when the Ordinary Boys came back, whenever that was, you know, they had gone slightly pop with that. So I'm going to say no, I don't think so. Do you?
No, not at all. No, I can't. I mean, if Steps can't do it, and let's not beat about the bush. We liked that Steps single because it was everything that is good about Steps, and they came back with a great deal of hoo-ha, and people didn't buy it enough to send it anywhere near up the charts, even with Ed Sheeran dominating the charts in the way that he did. That Step single only got to the lower 30s, and Ed Sheeran's only had 16 songs in the top 40 at that point. It wasn't like he had 35 songs and Steps were at number 36. It was, you know, they did, that single did not succeed as a single. I don't think it's going to harm Steps in any way at all. They're going to get their money from concert tickets and they will continue to be, you know, as revered by the people that like them as they always were. But it just felt like a shame that a really good song of that ilk could fail to succeed on what must be its own terms, which is to hit the top 40.
Well, yeah, I think this is where streaming lets a song like that down, because I'm sure when Steps put out an album, it will probably go top 10. And the audience for that kind of song probably aren't big streaming people. They're probably the kind of person who would have gone out and bought a single, or they'll wait until there's a CD that they can put in the car. I do think that's one of the major failings of the streaming chart, in that it's very much geared towards the kind of audience who listens to a kind of music in a particular kind of way.
Yes, there's a homogeneity to it, isn't there? So that is what makes the kind of choices made by Texas and the Kooks really interesting, because these are the two that we've picked out from the new releases pile as being, oh, what do they sound like now? And what we found out is that Texas sound like
Blondie.
The same.
If
if you loved her, you'd hate for her to be so free. Yeah, it sounded like Blondie. With that kind of slight stadium rock edge, because, you know, they've had to try and... It's a bit like when the Stereophonics came back with Dakota and it was slightly krautrocky. And Texas have by no means gone slightly krautrocky, but they have become slightly streamlined and slightly less bluesy, but still essentially that thing that they do is the same.
They were always really good at melody, I thought. You know, I was never a gigantic Texas fan, but I was fond of some of their songs because I thought that they could write great melodies. But this just, it feels really weak. Like, I listened to it a number of times earlier and I can't remember anything about it. Whereas, much as I would never stand for the Stereophonics, I do think Dakota is quite a catchy song.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is it. And actually, any boring meat and potatoes indie band that takes a leaf out of Krautrock book and speeds up a little bit is fine by me. Whereas the Kooks have tried to become they tried to boil down to their own essence.
Yes, exactly.
But the weird thing is
their
that
own
when
kookiness.
The Kooks, yeah, when the Kooks distilled, sound exactly like the Fratellis, which is an unexpected surprise. But they've beefed up what they do, that thing that they do, that scuffed kind of bouncy indie guitar thing, based on quote unquote classic melodies, quote unquote classic rhythms, you know, the way that everybody used to do it in the olden days, wear your chubby hat and all that.
He's still doing all that. I think one of the things that will make this really great or jar against what pop music mostly sounds like now to people who didn't experience the Kooks the first time around is he's still totally doing that quite hiccupy estuary English kind of thing, and that is just no part of pop's pronunciation anymore.
No, it's weird, isn't it? But people will quite happily accept whatever the hell Drake's doing. Nobody really wants Luke Kook to do that weird thing, that Larry the Lamb voice that he used to do. And what you spotted this, which I think is just wonderful. This is from their new Best Of compilation, the single Be Who You Are, it's called. The Texas song is called Tell That Girl, by the way. We've done a terrible job of actually explaining what we're talking about. The Kook song is called Be Who You Are, and it's taken from their Best Of compilation, which is called Best Of the Kooks, .. So far,
I think it's fair to say that the Best of the Kooks is certainly behind them. I would almost hazard a guess as to say the Best of the Kooks is contained in a very tiny corner of their debut album, but maybe that's uncharitable.
Well, even if it's not, you should never ever call your greatest hits Volume One or So Far. It's just the beginning. There is such a thing in music as tempting fate, and The Clash memorably released after they'd split up. Released a greatest hits that's called The Story of the Clash Volume 1, to which there is still never been a Volume 2. And The Clash aren't short on reissuing their own stuff, and they knew how many songs they had before they started.
But I think there's a difference between the ones that are obviously knowingly ironic. I mean, obviously, this Kooks one is meant to be ironic, I think, but the joke doesn't work because I don't think the Kooks are going to make any songs that become more popular than Naive. I can't actually think of the titles of any other Kooks songs.
She moves in her own way.
Yeah, that's the one.
Contains the most vainglorious lyric in the entire history of popular music. She came to my show just to hear about my day. Mirror kisser! Mirror kisser!
He also sounds a lot like Johnny Borrell on this new song, actually, talking about his pronunciation. And that story, that lyric, just reminded me of an incredible story that I once heard, which may or may not be true, so I'll throw the word allegedly in a number of times. But I once met a girl who had apparently dated Johnny Borrell or had been on a couple of dates with him. And I think on their first or second date, allegedly, he took her up to a rooftop in London and they looked out across the city and he said, just imagine how many people are listening to my music right now. Allegedly.
Move over, Luke Kook. There's room for more snogging on that mirror from Johnny Borrell. I mean, you want pop stars to be a bit like that. He's entirely redeemed whatever people who didn't like him used to think about him by writing about Razorlight in the early 90s for... What was the publication it was published in?
Vice.
Vice,
it was great. I think they made him review a lot of those... like indie rock revival, whatever it was called, songs, and it was brilliant. He's got a lot of self awareness, but also he's still utterly Johnny Borrell. Like, the self awareness hasn't come with a tempering down of anything about his personality.
Razor, like, the only gig I've ever been to where I've become aware that the lead singer has whatever the opposite of charisma is. I left after four songs. And it wasn't even an early days thing. I knew who Razor Light were. I think it was second or third album, and I got four songs in and just thought, wow, you're actually repellent. That's really, really interesting. I've never been to a gig where the singer is doing the opposite of whatever it is that, you know, because lead singers draw people in. He did not draw me in. He repelled me. It was like magnets, which we'll get back to in a minute.
I used to think he was incredibly sexy, but I had definitely dropped off by the point that he started wearing white jeans and no top. So I was very much confined to the first album sexiness. Right, onwards through the chart. Number five, Ed Sheeran with Castle on the Hill.
Summer of 69 for the millennials.
This is why Coldplay are having to collaborate with the Chainsmokers to actually kind of differentiate themselves, because he's just leapt right on their USP here.
Yeah, I don't know why he mentions breaking his leg at the beginning. I've become quite obsessed with Ed Sheeran's lyrics this week. And he mentions breaking his leg and then talks about rolling down the hill and smelling the grass. And then everything after that is, and everything was, of course, wonderful in my youth. You broke your leg. What are you talking about? Running away from your brothers. And then suddenly it's as if, oh, I wish I could go back there to having a broken leg. Is that what you mean? I don't know.
Yeah, I find this like very young person way for nostalgia, like thirst for nostalgia, really, really weird. Ed Sheeran is younger than me, and yeah, he's harking back on his childhood as if he's Dame Vera Lynn looking back on the war or something. And it goes hand in hand with that Lucas Graham song, and which is also awful.
I need that to be a hit again so that we can deconstruct it, because, oh my God, that and Rude by Magic are the two songs that I've shouted at. And my children listen to Heart FM a lot. Not that there's anything wrong with that. And when Rude and the Lucas Graham song 7 Years were on all the time, every time they came on, I had to deconstruct it for the kids. Just going, the thing you have to realise about this song while we're driving along, and they're, you know, they're 8, 9, and 10 at the time or whatever. They're just looking at me with horror. Dad, are you all right? No. The other thing about Rude is this. No, I could do chapter and verse for ages. I can't recreate it now. But maybe if enough people listen to those songs and make them hits, I will.
Yeah, maybe we can start manipulating the charts as well. Come on, guys. Start listening to Rude loads so that we can talk about it. Thanks.
Right, at number four, Clean Bandit featuring Zara Larsson and Symphony, which, again, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to do the grammar thing, but it contains a tautology in the lyrics. She sings, was solo singing on my own. She only needs to sing, was solo singing, or was singing on my own. There's no need to reinforce that point by saying solo singing on my own, because solo means on your own. It's like 3 a.m. in the morning.
Yep, it reminds me of, I quite often explain to people, I was reading a website on the internet and I'm like, oh no, wait, why have I just said that? It's like when I accidentally typed Google into Google.
And the internet exploded.
Yeah, very tired. Number three is Drake and Passion Fruit, which I will say, you know, in the 4 weeks that we've been doing this podcast, this is the only song from the top 10 that I have purchased and made my own. I like it very much.
It's also one of the few songs in pop music at the moment that doesn't mention its own title. So it's like Smells Like Teen Spirit or Bohemian Rhapsody. At no point does he use the word passion fruit. I know I said earlier on that he does it in that sense of using the word passion as the passion of the Christ, and it's an allegory for suffering in love, but he doesn't actually sing anything about passion fruit at any point during the song.
Well, in many ways, this is the top 10 this week's My Ding-a-ling, because clearly he's referring to something else, not his love of exotic fruits.
Oh my God, it's literally about his passion fruit. It's like his love cucumber.
Moving on, a song that I wish did not have its title in it, because I only need to read these words to get it stuck in my head, as I think I said last week, is Ed Sheeran's Galway Girl, which I hate so much and I hear so often that I worry that I'm almost starting to like it somehow.
That's Stockholm Syndrome. You're developing pop Stockholm Syndrome. The person I feel mostly for in all this is Stuart Lee, because he did a whole routine about the use of beloved pop cultural artifacts in advertising, based around a Magnus advert. And if anyone knows the routine, and they know, I can't possibly summarize it. It goes on and on and on brilliantly. But at the end, it ends with him singing the Steve Earle song, The Galway Girl, which was written by Steve Earle about a trip to Ireland that he took during his rehab from alcoholism. And he literally met a girl, I don't know if it's in Galway or, you know, but he met someone who helped him. And that song was then used in an advert for cider, I think. I mean, the trouble with Stuart Lee is the facts that he gives you are sometimes questionable. So that's the truth within the routine that he does anyway. And so he does a version of The Galway Girl by Steve Earle, in which he's singing about how adverts are used, you know, pop songs are used in adverts, and they can somehow destroy your relationship with the original item. And especially if that relationship is based on something quite personal to you. And then Ed Sheeran releases a song called Galway Girl, which sounds exactly like a cider ad. And it must just steamroller over the whole, whatever it is that he was attempting to do with that comedic routine, which was, if I keep singing this song, maybe I can develop a new batch of personal memories to go with it so that I can reconnect with a song that I'm really passionate about. Ed Sheeran has applied a steamroller to and ironed it all out flat, because now you can't even type Galway Girl into Google without getting the Ed Sheeran song come up.
What advert could this be on that would destroy it? Destroy the Ed Sheeran version of the song. I can't think of what the opposite of it would be.
No, because, I mean, it's so written for the Irish Tourist Board, isn't it? Gosh, what could it be for? I mean, it would be for something like Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it would actually square the circle completely, wouldn't it? If you've got a Steve Earle song that was loosely based on his recovery from alcoholism that's then used to advertise cider, then we take this one, which is another one of Ed Sheeran's many songs about getting drunk and meeting a girl in a bar.
Well, yeah, it's a song about a high-functioning alcoholic who can play the fiddle, dance the ceilidh and do a lot whilst having imbibed a lot of drink.
Well, and using only tortilla chips to absorb the alcohol in their systems. Yeah, so okay, well, there's something for AA then. So but then you can't ruin Ed Sheeran songs. They are unruinable,
indestructible.
Yeah.
Well, yes. And at number one is Ed Sheeran with Shape of You, which you're going to try and ruin with your grammar guide again. But
well, only because
I don't think you're going to put a big dent in it.
No, it is sort of the song of the year already, isn't it? There's nothing I can do. But I would like to point out that the line "push and pull like a magnet do," whilst being grammatically incorrect, just because you don't say "push and pull like a magnet do," it's like a magnet does, should be "push and pull like two magnets do." Magnets don't do anything on their own. They either repulse or attract to other magnets or to iron, but like "push and pull like a magnet do" makes even less sense than it does grammatical sense. And also, while we're on Ed Sheeran's lyrics, in Perfect, he sings the line "you between my arms" as if it's a romantic thing, but you don't hold somebody between your arms. You hold them in your arms. That's an embrace. Between my arms sounds like he's holding his arms directly forward, straight out, and someone has just stood between them, and they could leave anytime they want. So it's not quite as tender a thing. He has a really odd way of these really odd, imprecise, ungrammatical descriptions, which are supposed to sound tender and yet actually sound a bit strange.
Well, yeah, I think "Shape of You" is a classic one. It's like he's appraising livestock or something. I mean, the song. The illogical lyric in this song that gets me more than "push and pull like a magnet do" is still "you and me are thrifty, so we go all you can eat, fill up your bag and I fill up a plate." And this is also, I think, the song where they drink cider out of champagne cans. So, A, Ed Sheeran, millionaire, has taken a girl to an all-you-can-eat Chinese buffet, presumably. Whilst he's put his dinner on his plate, he's made her fill her bag with sweet and sour chicken, and then they've had to decant champagne into cider cans in some kind of wayward attempt to shore up his, like, everyman credibility. It makes me want to go on a date with Ed Sheeran, perversely, just to really see what he's like.
Well, he would just comment that at the end of the date, after a night of sweet conversation and, you know, tender, sweet nothings spoken into each other's ears, that the only thing he can remember is is your outline. He likes the perimeter of you and not anything that you've said or anything that you are or even particularly how you look like. It's just your, you know, your general silhouette that he likes.
But also the smell you left on his bed sheets, which I even though it's not dirty to have somebody sleep in your bed and for it to smell like them the next day, like, that's fine. If it was like a month later, you'd be like, come on, Ed, wash your sheets. There's still something profoundly creepy about that.
The way that you explained it then, the smell you left on his bed sheets, sounds like you did it on purpose as well, which is even worse.
Well, that would be me on a date with Ed Sheeran, doing it on purpose. We are going to... So that's the end of this week's Top 10. We're going to read out one of the many emails that we've had in, which is from Maria, who sent an email about a number of things, but she made some particularly interesting points about songwriters. She says she's interested in what the relevance of singles are at a time when every song off the Ed Sheeran album can make it into the chart. Why do we need to appoint singles anymore? She says, what's their worth nowadays? Non-singles do get radio play sometimes too. Sure, they still do their promotional work, I suppose. However, if Sheeran has managed to get the charts of this date, then surely others can follow. This makes me quite interested to find out what songwriters and producers think about it. Streaming has given importance to non-single tracks, definitely. I do wonder if songwriters, artists and producers work differently now when it comes to the whole album. Do they view each track as a single, or do they just leave the select few to do their work? Or perhaps they'll start to think about it now after Sheeran's record. Again, this would probably apply to the more established artists. Maybe the production process might change for some now they know they can get a whole album in the charts. I know Wiley has said that he views each track on his album as a single and not a collective. I wonder if either of you had ever had this conversation with someone.
I think it's very rare to have an interview with anybody that is a songwriter or creative for them not to at some point issue the sentence, we tried to make our album as much like a collection of singles as possible. That is definitely a mindset, because it suggests that you're working fully within the pop genre, which is to maximize the potential of every single song. So you're not aiming necessarily for a broad thematic sweep of songs that all are broadly similar, so that your album sounds like a novel in music form. It's a series of short stories. That's the pop way of working. So yes, I definitely have had that conversation with songwriters, but I wouldn't say that. Have you had interview situations where people have said, since streaming, we've had to think about this more?
No, but also I don't interview a great deal of pop stars. So they're probably not thinking about their albums in that way.
Yeah, and ultimately with pop stars, there's always that slight suspicion that you're not necessarily talking to the people who are at the most creative point in the creation of their back catalogue. I don't mean that they are puppets or anything like that, but there are songwriters that do a lot of songwriting work. So people like Sia might have a clearer view, but I haven't interviewed her to talk about it.
Oh yeah, well, she's totally brazen about the songwriting process. But I think somewhere that you can see this coming through really clearly is if we move on to the new releases that are coming out for next week. What's shaping up to be Calvin Harris's new album seems like, I mean, somebody like Calvin Harris, it's very obvious that he would think about every track as a single. I've never listened to a whole Calvin Harris album, but I imagine there's not, you know, a lot of deep cut album material on there. He's probably thinking of everything in terms of its commercial viability. And I think the two songs that we've heard from this record so far have both been massive grab bags of people. So we had the first one, which is called Slide, which featured Frank Ocean and Migos. And now there's a new one, which is called Heatstroke, which features Young Thug, Pharrell and Ariana Grande. Keep it real right now. I'm trying to beat it up, beat pills right now. Athletic in the sheets, I got skill right now. Red bread with some red, baby. Ballin' in that club, they some speed. Pop that bitch and spray like red. Yellow diamonds on you like a glass of lemonade. This is a deeply enjoyable song, but it's like whiplash. Well, it's like you've gone to a big house and everybody on this song is throwing a party in a different room, and they're all very different style parties that fit, like they complement their personalities, and you're wandering between them, and this song is kind of changing dramatically as you're going around it. And I think, you know, coming back to this idea about whether they view each track as a single, I think even more than viewing each track as a single now, it's almost like viewing each track as a composite of a number of different potential singles in order to maximize its kind of demographic appeal. You know, you would probably never get Ariana Grande and Young Thug in a room together, and I very much doubt that this song was recorded with them all in the studio at the same time. But this song is all over the place, but it kind of weirdly complements itself.
It's funny that in the way that if that is Calvin Harris's modus operandi now, he seems to be aping to a more commercially successful degree the way that Gorillaz put their albums together. But Gorillaz, you know, will literally throw people together who you just wouldn't imagine. And they're just about to come back. You know, they've got Jenny Beth and the Savages on their new album, and De La Soul is on there, and, you know, all sorts of people. It is that thing of whether you wonder whether people's listening habits, there needs to be something that happens every 30 seconds or so to make you get all the way through to the end of the track and want to play it again. Because whatever happens, it can't be so dense that you don't get it the first time around. And it can't be so repetitive that you only get it once and then you get to the end and don't play it again. So there has to be change, but it needs to be the kind of change that is easy to assimilate first time round and want to re-experience, because you know it's that jump from one thing to another, which I guess DJ culture is all about, has always been all about to an extent.
Yeah, totally. And actually, I do think this song kind of balance. I have never really had strong feelings about a Calvin Harris track in the past, but I think this song is great. I think it balances its weirdness really, really well. There was a great blog post on The Guardian by Michael Craig, which he wrote back in January, about how it's probably the Neptunes and Calvin Harris who are responsible for these kind of crowded credits where, you know, you've got X artist featuring so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. And he connects this back to the rise in streaming and the need to satisfy all comers at once, which is definitely true. But he also makes the point that this way of working creates like a default streaming platform sound, the sort of Spotify playlist mainstay that plays out like a vague approximation of Justin Bieber's 2015 Tropical House anthem, Sorry. And I think that's definitely true of a number of other songs that are in the top 10, but this song is distinctive and weird. You know, we were emailing earlier and we were talking about this great post on Tom Ewing's website, Freaky Trigger, where he talks about the decline of pop culture packages. He says that the top 40 used to be a package, Top of the Pops was a package, the music press was a package, somewhere that, you know, created a little world and you had, like, you know, your main cast members in it, and then occasionally other people could flit into it. And he said these kind of packages don't exist anymore. But I think the way that we're seeing these packages repackaged, as it were, is with things like this Calvin Harris track, which recontextualizes a bunch of people who wouldn't fit together normally, and with Drake's More Life as well. You know, he's called it a playlist, but it's just a way of packaging a number of things that are inspiring him at the moment without necessarily putting a stamp of ownership on it.
And that is definitely true of Gorillaz. Like, I haven't even planned to make the Gorillaz connection, but it so works, because of all the people that really got into Bobby Womack after he'd appeared on the Gorillaz third album, and then, you know, went on to release his, you know, another album with the help of Damon Albarn, that was one of the most defining, the last defining moment of his career shortly before he died. So yeah, definitely that is a way of the artist curation thing, where you only have to process 30 seconds or, you know, a tiny amount of musical time with them to have a gist of what it is that they do, and then you can go off and just investigate. Because that's what streaming also allows you to do, is without any penalties in terms of money or anything like that, or difficulty of finding things, just to go off and say, well, I like that noise that so-and-so made on that record and I want to hear more of it. Where is it?
Exactly, yeah. I like the song. I think it's probably going to be a really big summer song, but it's surprisingly lewd. I don't know how much of it's they're going to be able to play on the radio, because the Young Thug lyrics are quite rude. I really, really enjoyed... You know, so there's a bit in there where he's talking about how much better he is than other rappers, and he says, but he's got, you know, a typically Young Thug way of phrasing it, where he says, no toilet tissue, I poop on because life is short. And I just think that's extraordinarily graphic. And then after that is this chorus that goes, release, let's go and have a good time, which I think is put in quite different context after the mention of, you know, toilet tissue and pooping.
It is quite a scatological moment.
I just love the idea that, you know, people have been, you know, pooping on their nemeses in rap for quite a long time, but I just like that he has to add no toilet tissue, just yeah, so you know he's really, really raw.
I mean, to be honest, if we're going to linger on this for a moment, if that was to happen, it wouldn't, if you were being pooed on, it wouldn't matter to you whether they wipe their bum afterwards or not, would it?
It would only inconvenience Young Thug, one would imagine.
Exactly. He'd end up walking around the rest of the day feeling slightly hot and itchy in the understairs department. whereas I'd be like, well, I've been pooed on by Young Thug and I don't like that, but I don't care whether he wiped his bum afterwards or not.
I think we should talk about Zayn and Party Next Door with their new single, Still Got Time. This could be something if you let it be something. Don't scare me away. Turn something's into nothing, babe. You're already. I think in this song, Zayn sounds a lot like Drake. He's doing that thing where it sounds like, you know, he's trying to sing, but he's actually dribbling a little bit. There's a lot of water coming out of his mouth at the same time as he's trying to enunciate. And I don't know, I've just found this song all build and no satisfaction, really. There's no chorus, and it doesn't even have that kind of like subtly insidious catchiness like something like One Dance. Though I do like the synths in the chorus, which I know there's something about the way that those synths sound always reminds me of, like, you know, some insects singing a little song.
Yeah, I think the thing with this is that I want... Again, it sounds like the product of somebody who is so secure in their own, you know, ability to be heard because he's Zayn Malik, who used to be in One Direction, that he doesn't seem to need to feel the sonically try hard to gain your attention. And that's sort of what I was saying about Harry Styles, is I want former boy band members to smack me around the face with how astonishing they are. You know, that's, and I want that from every single musician who ever makes a song ever. And astonishing doesn't mean raucous, it doesn't necessarily mean faster or louder or bigger or anything like that. It just means different. And for Zayn to sort of come out with this as a key track, and it's a sort of, you know, like you said, it's a dribbly come on of a song, I think it's perfectly fine, but what I want it to do is to knock my teeth out.
Yes, well, I think the interesting thing is somebody like Harry Styles seems very comfortable with his past in a boy band. You know, there's not been the point where he's tried to distance himself from it or anything like that. He seems like quite a chilled out guy. And so you imagine that would let him come back with quite a bombastic thing, because he's not trying to distance himself from that very high octane boy band level of entertainment. Whereas with Zayn, you know, obviously he didn't really like being in that band towards the end, and he didn't like the persona that he was having to play. And so his comeback has been all about how he's very cool and very restrained, and he's a real artist. Because at the moment, real artists, whether it's Solange or Blood Orange or Frank Ocean, they're very understated. You know, look at people like Sampha as well, and he definitely wants to be part of that kind of cool crowd. Whereas I think Harry Styles strikes me as somebody who doesn't have those kind of hang-ups and might be more willing to come back with a big, you know, earth song, let me entertain you kind of banger, which is what I hope he does.
It's quite entertaining the way that we've managed to forge a whole podcast out of not having heard one of the songs, but I, you know, that's basically the ground level that we want him to hit. That's the bar he has to jump over.
I think we'll have heard it by the time we record next week, so we'll be able to linger on it then.
Excellent. So what have we been listening to this week, Laura?
My most streamed song this week is a song called Fontaine de Lait, which means Fountain of Milk, by a French singer called Camille. And she released her first album in 2002, and then her best album in 2005. And she makes electronic pop music, but there's always kind of quite a high concept in her productions, but she executes it with like this joyful level of silliness. There's a song on one of her albums which literally, like, she makes a percussive sound out of the sound of her actual fart, which she's recorded. But this new song is called Fontaine de Lait, and the lyrics in French, she uses a lot of words that sound really similar to show you how they kind of, like, you only need to tweak one syllable or one vowel or something for it to turn it, for the meaning to slip slightly. And the lyrics in the song are about, basically about how when a lady has sex with a man, the sperm eventually, through the transformative processes of the female body, come out the other end of the lady as milk, which sounds ridiculous and high concept and really, really silly, but she makes it work really well. I think it's a beautiful song, so we can listen to a bit of that. Fraser, what was your most streamed song this week?
Well, mine was nowhere near as graphic as that. Although, to be honest, I've listened to the whole song in French and I don't speak French, and it sounds really, you know, poised and lovely. And then you told me what the lyrics meant. I went, okay. Which, you know, again, is a brilliant thing. Mine is, genuinely, I have been transported by the album that Jarvis Cocker did with Chilly Gonzalez, called Room 29, which is a suite of songs that has been written to kind of dramatize the Hollywood liaisons that took place in Room 29 of the Chateau Marmont Hotel in Hollywood. And it includes, you know, there's stories in there about Howard Hughes and about Gene Harlow, but it's also, because it's Jarvis Cocker most of the time who's done the lyrics, there are interview segments with Hollywood journalists that sort of get woven in, but the Jarvis Cocker stuff is Jarvis Cocker being Jarvis Cocker. So it's that really pulp thing of mixing the glamour of the everyday with the kind of everyday squalor of glamour. So the sort of encounters described, a lot of which are either romantic or, you know, they're not graphically sexual, but they're certainly romantic, are, you know, there's something really grubby, because it's Jarvis, you know, he can do grubby and make it sound romantic beautifully. So there's a song on that album called Tearjerker, which just has one of the absolute killer opening lines in all of music, as far as I'm concerned.
You are such a jerk. You are a tearjerker. You don't need a girlfriend. Need a social worker.
So that's Tearjerker by Jarvis Cocker and Chilly Gonzalez. And in all honesty, the whole album is like that. It's got that Eric Satie kind of piano minimalism thing underneath it. Jarvis Cocker kind of purring in your ear. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. It completely changes the room in which it's played, which is, you know, often one of the things I really want from music. So that's it for this week. Thank you very much for listening and subscribing to Unbreak My Chart. You can email your thoughts on the charts or any of the nonsense that we've been talking about this week, or any reviews of any particular chart bothering songs or artists, to unbreakmychartpod@gmail.com. And if you're listening outside the UK, please do get in touch and let us know about any enjoyable anomalies going on in your home chart.
If you want to listen to any of the songs we've discussed in this week's podcast, we've put the good ones, i.e. no Ed Sheeran, in a Spotify playlist, which is linked in the show notes.
And you can find us both on Twitter at
Laura Snapes
and at @CSI_popmusic. And we'd love it if you had left us a review on iTunes. Tell your friends. See you next week.
Bye.